We have them, we don't use them. All right, I want to welcome everyone to season two, Great Rabbis of the 20th Century, sponsored again by Becky Navi Katzel, Ila Nishmas, Yonah Ben Rabari and Leib. Just so you should know some of the parameters, if you're new, this is really the second year we're doing it, but you shouldn't think that these are tier two great rabbis. It's not true. They're all great, all different, and we'll see how each individual in his lifetime was extremely impactful on Jewish events, on certainly Talmidim, even the shape and the culture of Jews. So tonight we're discussing, this is part 10, Rav Yitzhak Kuttner, Zecher Tzadik Livracha. Rav Kuttner is best known, of course, as the Rosh Yeshiva of Mesivta Chaim Berlin for almost 40 years, Chaim Berlin in Brooklyn, and then a branch in Israel. And his influence is primarily felt through his force of personality, his Torah thoughts, faithful Talmidim. But that's really the beginning of the story. I've no doubt he shaped the American Jewish scene after World War II and the decades after World War II, although his lasting influence really is debatable. Like almost all the rabbis we've discussed up to this point, he was not from a cookie-cutter background. His background was unique. His influences were eclectic. His political and philosophical shifts in his lifetime were also uncommon. And he was not above feuds or acerbic comments about his perceived rivals. His was a complicated greatness, but greatness nonetheless, and the testament to that greatness is the massive compilation of his Torah thoughts, a multi-volume set of ma'amarim called Pachad Yitzchak, divided mainly among the various holidays of the year and Shabbos, and a collection of his letters and thoughts, and the Sefer Zikaron is a biography, but also some of his Divrei Torah. As far as I know, on the American scene, he was really the first to introduce the Maharal into his worldview and teaching. But he was also defined by his opposites. He was a devotee of Rav Kook when he lived in Israel in the late 20s, who became, in essence, an anti-Zionist. He was a supporter as well as a skeptic of secular education, or at the very least, he neither saw it as a value nor as something that was completely forbidden. He was a member of the Matzah Gedolei HaTorah, but also a maverick. He was misnaged, but also a chassid. He was a man who had many close Talmidim, but also a falling out with many other Talmidim. So it was a complicated greatness. How do we understand his life and his legacy? Yitzhak Kuttner was born in the spring of 1906 in Warsaw, Poland, thus later known as the Warszawa Eloi. His parents were Chaim Yoel and Chana Kuttner, both from distinguished rabbinic families. He was educated privately by his father and tutors until age 15. So he had no formal schooling. He really never went to yeshiva until age 15. Like Rav Kook, whose disciple he became, he came from a mixed marriage. One parent was a misnaged, one was Hasidic, and of course, Warsaw had a very strong ger presence. Like Rav Kook, Rav Kuttner was an inveterate writer from his earliest youth, recording his thoughts and feelings and experiences in diaries. He remembered well the very first Masechta he learned as a child, Baba Kama, but he noted that although his memory of it was strong, his understanding of it was relatively childish compared to later Masechtos, such as youth. Very often our comprehension is shaped by the way we first learn something. We go through this every year. It's hard for many people to understand the complexity and the beauty and the depth in the stories of Bereishis, because we first learned them when we were 4 or 5 years old. In 1921, he entered yeshiva for the first time, age 15. He went to Lomja, but he was just there for a few months. In fact, he came there just a year after my own grandfather left Lomja. It was then when he encountered the first great influence in his life, He entered the Slobodka Yeshiva, all of 15 years old, surrounded by some of the greatest Talmidei Chachamim of the age, and coming into the orbit of the Alter of Slobodka, was one of our topics last year, and the Alter of Nosson Zvi Finkel took an immediate liking to him. He became a regular at the Alter Shabbos table. He recorded in his diary that he came to Slobodka with many questions and problems, but with the realization that until I have what he called Hashkafat Olam Shleimo Makefet, a complete and all-encompassing worldview, it's not that he won't only be a Talmud Chacham, he won't even be Musari, won't even be an ethical person. In Slobodka, of course, one did more than just learn Gemara and Halacha. At its core was Musar, and time was carved out daily for Musar Shmuos, to develop this unique worldview. Rav Huttner later wrote that to his thinking, Shmuas are not what people think they are. What do we think they are? This is a term that was developed to distinguish Shmuas from Shiurim in Gemara, Torah, Halacha, etc. Or even simply that in a Shmuas, or Shmuz as they say, the Talmud simply hears, Lishma, listens to the talk from the Rebbe. He didn't say that. In fact, he said, Shmuos are Sichat Hadamin Nafsho. It's a conversation with one's soul. I mean, you hear the Musa from the Rebbe, and then it's all about listening and responding. Shvishidulo, Shumishadel at Nafsho, Lekiyum, Toch Kadei Limud. Try to persuade the soul to implement these lessons as they're being heard. So it's not a dialogue, nor is it just passive, easy listening. The emphasis is on the Shomea, and this the teenage Yitzhak Huttner took to heart. His pursuit was not only ethical perfection, Shleimut, but also Hekef, well-roundedness. And this attitude would manifest itself in his own life, as well as in his attitudes towards secular knowledge, and even the variety of Torah schools of thought. He held as his objective in learning to convert Yediyah Sichlit intellectual knowledge to Yediyah Chushit, knowledge that is tangible, that's impactful on the soul, and therefore enduring. So from 1921 to 1934, when he came to the United States, Rav Huttner embarked on an odyssey of Torah. He was extremely meticulous and is always methodical in his records. So for example, Erev Rosh Hashanah 1924, he recorded in his diary, these are the thoughts I had during Maariv last night, the last Maariv of the year. I would imagine it's not like our thoughts during Maariv, different thoughts. Many letters were written to his parents, whom he rarely saw after age 15 and left home. And interesting, until age 15, he almost never left home. From age 15 on, he almost never went back home to Warsaw. So he planned to stay in Slobodka for 4 years and then return to Warsaw. But in 1924, as you all recall, the Alta moved part of the yeshiva to Israel and established a branch in Hebron. In the spring of 1925, Rav Huttner joined the Alta in Hebron. He was enamored with the spiritual qualities of the land of Israel. And this began an intense period of learning, especially including Ikarim, Ikarei Hashkafa, meaning ideas about Jewish thought, especially the Yesodot, the fundamentals of Yadus. The Alter died in 1927, but Rav Huttner continued learning in Hebron, where he found peace and tranquility, and he writes, no distractions. He said of Hebron, it's an Arab village, but you're really unaware of it when inside the yeshiva. Alas, not for long. He escaped the horrific massacre of Jews, including some of his own fellow Talmidim, by murderous Arabs in August 1929, only because he'd returned to Europe a few months earlier. In the Alter's absence, he sought out Rav Kook, who by then was the chief Ashkenazic rabbi of the land of Israel, and he began a close relationship that became awkward long after Rav Kook's death in 1935. It was Rav Kook who introduced Rav Huttner to the writings of the Maharal. In Rav Kook, Rav Huttner found a kindred spirit rooted in both halacha and mysticism, grounded in all of Torah, but also possessed of a poetic soul, an indefatigable writer. Both giants wrote works of halacha and philosophy, but also poetry, the outpouring of the soul. In Rav Kook's expression, he said, "I don't write because I have to. I write because I cannot keep silent. I cannot keep it within me." Rav Huttner said at one point, "I speak poetry, and they wish to hear prose." Both men's discourses, therefore, are often very difficult to follow, and they're certainly not accessible to the average individual. Fortunately, there's no one average here tonight. Years later, Rav Huttner told Rav Moshe Tzinaria that if I would not have met Rav Kook, I'd be lacking 50% of myself. And Eliezer Waldman writes that Rav Huttner once told him that Rav Kook was 20 times as great as those who opposed him. So for many years, Rav Huttner had a picture of Rav Kook hanging in his sukkah, and he always maintained warm relations with Rav Tzvi Yehuda and Rav Neria, and yet he broke with Rav Kook in a way, never citing him in his writings, even when the influence was there, removing his picture from his sukkah in the early 1950s and replacing with one of the Chazon Ish, and mainly because of Zionism. It was part of his metamorphosis that he went from positive, even warm and deferential feelings towards Rav Kook to outright anti-Zionism, much more overt in his opposition than, say, Moshe Feinstein, and with an open contempt for religious Zionism. And in many ways, especially regarding Zionism, he was admittedly an open follower of the Satmar Rebbe. So it's not surprising that the Sefer Zikaron was published by his family, including a biography of Rav Huttner. They mention that when he came to Israel, he interacted with five gedolim of the time. Rav Kook should have been prominent. Instead, he's mentioned last, and he's the only one whose initials are used and not his full name. Rav Yosef Chaim Zonenfeld, Zatzel, is spelled out. Rav Kook, it just says, Harav Aleph period, Yud period, Kook, Zatzel. For sure, this was a different time in Jewish history. In 1929, Yitzhak Huttner returned to Warsaw briefly. It was his first visit in 8 years. And then he traveled to Berlin to study in the university there for less than a half year. It's not clear that he was actually matriculated, but he did study there, including philosophy. This is also omitted. It was just a reference, the way his daughter wrote it. He went to Medinat Ashkenaz to learn about the lives of the Jews there. Well, that's an understatement. In Berlin, he met and befriended two great rabbanim. One was Rav Yosef Dov Halevi Soloveitchik, and the second was Rav Menachem Mendel Schneerson. Among others, he interacted with these three D'Eish as well. He would befriend both of them, and he would have sort of strained relations with both of them over the decades when they came to America. If Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky made it a point of pride that he never let philosophical differences affect a personal relationship, Rav Yitzhak Huttner was unencumbered by that principle. He became a fierce critic of Chabad and of the Rebbe personally. Others say that it's exaggerated, but in one report, at first he saw in one of the Chabad publications that it had deprecated traditional Gemara learning in yeshiva as the dry and inspirational Shor Shenogach Es Hapara, the ox gored cow. And the article went on to say that that's something that would be relevant to young Jews only if Hasidus was able to extract the pnimius, the inner essence of the Gemara. That, of course, was anathema to Rav Huttner. And later he became disenchanted, to say the least, with the escalating messianism that he saw in Chabad and the cult of personality around the Rebbe. If we say that is not unlike the reaction of some others, his attitude towards Rav Soloveitchik was more inexplicable. At one point, he forbade his students from attending the Rav Shiurim. A story that made the rounds, I heard this from Rav Rakefet, one of Rav Huttner's closest Talmidim, Rav David Cohn, heckled the Rav during a hesped the Rav was giving for his uncle, the Briska Rav, I think it was 1959, for something that the Rav said, praising his uncle, that David Cohn perceived as critical of the Chazon Ish. I mean, it's a Lampert auditorium. Who heckles? The Rav. Rav Rakefet reported the next day, Rav Hudna called Rav David Cohn to praise him. What was the main issue? I'm sure the Rav's affiliation with Mizrahi was at the top of the list. And yet, after Berlin, Rav Hudna returned to Warsaw, and there lived Rav Moshe Soloveitchik, the Rav's father, who was soon embarking, somewhat rushed, he needed a job, and by himself, for America, with his wife and children to come at some point in the future. His youngest child, Aaron Soloveitchik, was then 12 years old. Who did Rav Moshe ask to tutor and watch over his young son? It was Rav Yitzhak Hutner. And the two became very close. It was Rav Hutner who was there for the boy's bar mitzvah. And Rav Aaron Soloveitchik later taught at Misifta Chaim Berlin while he was attending law school until he left for reasons we'll discuss later. In 1930, Rav Hutner returned to Hebron and to Yerushalayim. Then he went to Kovna for several years while he wrote his master halachic work, Toras HaNazir, establishing his credentials in a traditional Litvish way. Then back to Warsaw, 1932, where he married a young woman visiting from America, Masha Lipschitz. Then back to Israel, 1934, where he reluctantly left, writing that the land of Israel, Mushrash Aniba, I'm rooted there. Vehihi karkai nikati, it is the land of my nourishment. He felt like a tree that was being uprooted and replanted elsewhere. Kaful hukeivo, it's a double pain in leaving the land of Israel. And there he bid farewell to Rav Kook, who died a year later. Then he went back to Europe to do work on another book, on a commentary on the Sifra, and then to America, Brooklyn to be precise, which is part of America, 1934, where he remained there until he made Aliyah about 40 years later. It's a very formative journey of 13 years. I think he was 16 when he left home, 15 when he left home, 13 years of exploration, of self-exploration, learning from different sources and influences in order to be able to carve out his own path. He said of himself, citing the Gemara in Sanhedrin, of Lamed Ches Amar Aleph, Adam Arishon Mikol Ha'olam Kulo Hutzbar Afro. The Gemara says that Adam Rishon was created as a composite of earth from soil from different parts of the earth, meaning he was a conglomerate of many lands. So too, Rav Hutner said, Afanit Savur Mipinot Shanot Shel Aretz. I too am a product of so many different corners of the earth, Poland, Lithuania, Riga, Germany, Israel, and the United States. He later said that had he stayed in Israel and not gone to America, life would not have allowed him the ihizdahut, the lack of identification, or better said, the independence that his spirit required. He very much was an independent personality, and so much of his personality really was hidden. His greatest treasure, it was, as he said, pratiyut, privacy. And so people saw different sides of him, thinking that was him, much like the altar of whom Rabbi Yaakov Kamenetsky said, you could take his five top disciples, all different, and all a reflection of the altar. As if to say, one saw his front, his back, his right, his left from above. You could say the same thing about Rav Hutner. No one description encompasses him, and that became clear when he assumed his most famous position. So he arrived in America in the mid-1930s. He found a job teaching in Torah V'Das. Soon he became the office manager at Misifta Chaim Berlin, began giving a shiur. 1940, he became the Rosh Yeshiva. Early 1940s, Agav Urcha, he invited an old colleague from Slobodka, Professor Shaul Lieberman, to teach, to give a shiur in Chaim Berlin, but Professor Lieberman instead took a job at JTS for more money and the opportunity to focus on independent research. It's unimaginable such a thing would happen today, how history changes based on one decision. In 1956, Rav Huttner established the Kol Gur Aryeh for advanced students. So eventually there were three branches until today. A high school, a post-high school yeshiva, and a kollel. There was always some controversy following him. First, he saw himself as the Rosh Yeshiva, and he brooked no competition. A number of points became clear over the years, and they illustrate his personality in all its complexity. First, when he became the Rosh Yeshiva in 1940, the existing Rosh Yeshiva and other top officials, Rav Snow, Rav Shorkin, and others, left. They were expected to be deferential and to follow Rav Huttner in all matters, and many could not, even just on philosophical, not personal grounds. Second, he brought to America something that was not indigenous and had not been seen or practiced since Europe. The overt, demonstrative, somewhat stiff, or just very formal acts of kavod directed at him. So no doubt it was done to impress on an unwilling populace the importance of kavod haTorah. What do you mean? He might have been the first American Rosh Yeshiva to insist on being addressed in the third person. He wasn't Rav Huttner, he wasn't Rebbe, he was the Rosh Yeshiva. As in, what is the Rosh Yeshiva's opinion on such and such? Instead of, how are you? How is the Rosh Yeshiva? So to me, it's always sounded a little stilted, and I can't tell you how many times I've received calls that begin, I'm calling on behalf of the Rosh Yeshiva, or on behalf of the yeshiva, and I say very softly, what Rosh Yeshiva? What yeshiva? The call just assumes there's only one. Or his aides insisted that when people left him, they walk out backwards. So the Rosh Yeshiva should not see the person's back. You walk like this, like we walk away from the Aron HaKodesh. Shouldn't show your back to the Rosh Yeshiva. Rav Akiva tells a story that I saw elsewhere as well, of Rav Yeruchim Gerelik, the fiery Rosh Yeshiva at Reeds, who didn't really fit in at YU, went to see Rav Huttner regarding enrolling his son there. They had a very pleasant meeting. Rav Gerelik left, normal style, and he was stopped at the door by the gabbai, who told him that his method of departure was not appropriate. He should walk back in and then walk out backwards with his back to the door. Rav Gerelik did not take kindly to this, to say the least, and never hesitated to give Rav Huttner Mishaberach whenever his name came up. I don't know if his son wound up in Chaim Berlin. Another story, also multiple sources, but this I heard from Rav Kevin, I saw in writing as well. And you see the mentality and why it exists, and why I submit it's not a question of gaiva, it's not arrogance. Rav Huttner was in a taxi in Israel with a Talmud. Gets into the taxi, and the driver sees two individuals in rabbinic garb. He reaches into his glove compartment and puts a cap on his head. They leave, and Rav Huttner says to his Talmud, who knows the amount of Olam Haba that man earned by just that one simple act? And the Talmud said, that's all? That's all it requires? And Rav Huttner said, that is everything. And he told the following story about the Chidushi Harim, the Ger Rebbe, living in Warsaw. So the Hasidim go to mikveh every day. So the Ger Rebbe could have taken a short route from his home to the mikveh through alleyways. Would take him just a few minutes. And instead he insisted on walking through the main street, the main thoroughfare in Warsaw. His aide was puzzled by it, and when he was asked why he did it, he said, just watch. So they turned the corner onto the main street. Word went out from the Jewish porters. It was a job. They schlepped the suitcases, other things, from place to place. The Rebbe is gekumen. And the porters, many of whom were not religious, would stand there, they'd straighten their caps. When the Chidushim walked by, they would slightly bend their heads until the Rebbe passed them. He saw it as a way to have these simple Jews show their kavod haTorah, their respect for Torah. And it's true, it's something quite lacking in American Jewry. We're raised in an egalitarian, anti-authoritarian culture. Kovar HaTorah is almost non-existent in the modern Orthodox world, with exceptions, of course. Even the Haredi world, all assertions aside, it's very often reserved for one's Rosh Yeshiva, one's Rebbe, but not necessarily conferred on other Rosh Yeshiva, another Rebbeim. I don't doubt for a moment it was all for Kovar HaTorah. And for most rabbis, it's not personalized. That's not to say that those who don't enjoy it. Rabbi Wein used to say that rabbis reach a certain madrega when they don't even notice who stands and who doesn't stand when they walk into a room. Most people pay no attention to it, but Rav Huttner thought there was an important lesson in all of this, in Kovar HaTorah. You should know the opposite extreme was Rav Shraga Feivel Mendelovich of Torah Vadas, who insisted on being called Mr. Mendelovich for the opposite reason. He should not be considered remote or lofty or above everyone. He was a Mr. like all the others. But Rav Huttner offered the parable, you find this in Ezekiel 132, of a town that high, there was a clock high above the public square. And of course, why keep a clock so high? So he said there's two reasons. One, that everybody should be able to see it, like that clock over there. But the second reason, he said, was to discourage people from setting the clock to conform to their own personal watches. I've heard the mashal elsewhere used to say why we keep the Torah in a locked Aron HaKodesh. Because the Torah is lying around, everyone would take out and add what they wanted to. So you keep the clock high so you can't set your watch to it. I mean, so you can't set the clock to your watch. You have to set your watch to the clock. He said there are communities that don't put their Rav in a high place, so everyone approaches him, everyone wants to adjust him to fit their personal needs, to shape him as they want him to be, and so the whole purpose of the Mora de Asra is lost. That's how he saw Kovar HaTorah, and to a great extent he brought it to America, which didn't really exist before. Third, I think part of this process, he brought to America the synthesis of the Rosh Yeshiva and the Hasidic Rebbe. What's the picture here? No, it's without a hat. On Shabbos, he was the first combination ever happened before. He came, Slobodka, almost no one had a beard. He came to America, he grew a beard, then he began wearing Hasidic garb with a gartel. On Shabbos, he wore first strimal. He conducted Tishin, where he gave many of his mamarim. None of these things happened in the traditional yeshiva. And of course, like the traditional Hasidic Rebbe, he brooked no dissent from his staff, from the Rosh Yeshiva he hired for the yeshiva, or from his Talmidim either. So he had many Talmidim, many. But you were either his disciple 100%, or he wrote you off. So he had disciples who had to leave because they were just a little different, a little open-minded, or thought differently. They were not willing to completely subjugate their personalities or their thoughts to him. So Rav Aaron Soloveitchik was tutored by him in Warsaw. He later learned at Chaim Berlin, later became a Rebbe at Chaim Berlin, but he left. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein entered Chaim Berlin, he was 13 years old. He stayed there learning intensively for 5 years. He had a very warm relation with Rav Huttner. He too left and never looked back. It doesn't mean they left in anger, Rahmanul Islam, but they could not be deferential. How eclectic were his Talmidim? Shlomo Kalbach, the singer, was his Talmud. And Rav Huttner reportedly gave him smicha. David Weiss Halivni was his Talmud. They too left. It's a very, very diverse group. And of course he had many mainstream Talmidim, famous, influential. Rav Yaakov Perlow, the Novominska Rebbe, Rav David Kohn I mentioned before, Feivel Kohn, Rav Shlomo Freifeld, the great Kiruv Rabbi in Far Rockaway, many others as well. Now for his Talmidim, he had a very intense and personal love, but it was intense. He wanted to know every detail of their lives. He helped them with their decisions, rejoiced with them, cried with them, and rebuked them as necessary. So look first in our reader for this evening. In number one, he says to a Talmud Aruch, it's Igeres Kuf Yudalid, Michtavi kibalti hayom, yafeh asita shekatavta ta michtav hazeh. It's good that you wrote this letter. I was caused much pain by the relationship you expressed when you came to visit me. And he says, Sheikar Tsar, most of my pain was not because a makpid on your behavior, but rather the Rachmanus, Machmana Rachmana Alecha Shigata De Madrigasu, Rachmanus I have for you at the way you've been acting. It's because of that Rachmanus I wanted to help you, and that's why you Hapanima Zofo Chareti Lucha. I showed you an angry face. Hapanim alalu haya omnam zafo mibachutz. It was angry on the outside, but inside it was filled with the hope that you'll rectify your deeds. And he goes on to say that, so, I mean, a Talmud came to see him, and he basically was angry at him. There are many stories. A Talmud would come, and he'd turn his back on him. He'd yell at him. He'd get angry. He'd kick him out. Some would leave forever. Some would come back, duly chastened. Look at the next one, number 3 on the left side. It's a very important letter for a number of reasons. A Talmud writes to him about his spiritual level has fallen and all his hopes, his dreams are being crushed. So he says, I want to explain to you something. Third line. Roch Olohi, it's a terrible illness at Slainu, that when we think of the Shleimut, of the perfection of the Gedolim, all we do is look at the final product. We speak about how perfected they are. We completely skip over their internal struggle that their soul waged in order to reach that level. So all we have is the final product. He says, for example, everybody talks about is amazed at the nace, the miracle, Tarat HaLashon Shabbalah Chafetz Chaim, but the Chafetz Chaim and Lashon Hara, and the purity of his speech. Who knows the wars, the struggles, the stumbles, the falls, the trials the Chafetz Chaim had until he reached that level? Think it's easy? No, it's not so easy at all. 1 in 1,000, if not more, can reach it. So he sees the next paragraph. You love to throw in English expressions. You're in the stage of milchom of the Yetzer HaTov. Lose a battle and win the war. So they lose a battle, but the ultimate goal is to win the war. And then he says at the bottom of the small print, Avi, I want to impress upon you that if all your letter had done was Mesaper li alodora mitzvora masim tovim shalcha, all you do is tell me about all the mitzvahs and good deeds you're doing, I would have said, I got a michtav tov, I got a nice letter from you. But now that your letter tells me about your failures, your stumbles, hini omer shekibalti mimcha michtav tov ma'od, it's honest. I could say I got a very, very good letter from you because you're honest and you see your spirit is still stormy within you. It wants to improve. If you have given up, you wouldn't have written such a letter. So he says, in the last paragraph, Ein charotze lignovetati, you don't want to fool me. You don't want to deceive me that I will think you're in a place that you're not. So he thanked him for writing and he went on as to what he has to. So he had a very tough side. Perhaps even harsher than the altar in his tone. A Talmud wrote to him, just show you the tough side, a Talmud wrote to him once, it sounds very innocuous. He said, since Pesach, I'm busy giving shiurim. All right? Rav Huttner wrote back, how dare you use such a language that reeks of zilzul, derision, or flippancy? You're giving shiurim? He says, in truth, I cannot fathom the source of this flippancy. Maybe someday you'll explain it to me. That is tough. And yet he would spend endless hours in conversation with any student at any time, day or night, to help with a problem. Personal, halachic, philosophical, his dedication was limitless. Fourth, he had a very unique attitude to one of the big bugaboos of that day, secular education and college study. See, of course, I studied secular subjects, even attended college briefly, as I mentioned. He opposed the Wayu concept of Torah and Limud Echol under one roof, and yet he and Shraga Feivel Mendelovich had attempted to open a similar institution to Wayu in the late 1940s, even gaining a New York State Regents charter for it, meaning you'll have Limud HaKodesh, Limud HaKodesh, just like YU. but I don't know, holy or different, more Brooklyn-y, whatever, until they were pressured by Rav Aaron Cutler to stop, and Rav Huttner conceded, and I'm unaware of another person or another cause on which Rav Huttner conceded. And yet he would personally help Talmidim find the right night college or college after their years in yeshiva. He would even help them, some of them, choose their college courses and their professions in life. He didn't maintain that everyone had to sit and learn forever. He was open-minded, but he didn't broadcast that openness, which conflicted with the Haredi lifestyle, even though it didn't necessarily have to conflict. And here you have a number two, something I've quoted in Shul. It's a very famous letter, Igeres Tzadi Dalid. Talmud was going into a profession, and he complained to Rav Huttner, who begins, Ahuvi Chavivi, my beloved, that I received your letter, and the truth is, I enjoyed it because of what you said and the way you said it. And he said, I want you to know, the Talmud was worried about going into the world. What he was doing, lawyer, doctor, businessman. And he said that he thinks now, that the impression I'm getting from you is that you feel what you're doing is a secular career, he double life. You have your Jewish life, then you have your secular life, because you're working in the secular world. And so a double life is going to make you feel incomplete, that you're traitorous. He said, no. He said, a person who goes, who has a home, and then he has a hotel room, that's a double life. If you rent an apartment that has two rooms, that's not a double life, that's a broad life. And he mentions the story of the famous Dr. Valach, who was the head of Shari Tzedek, that before he would go to a chola, or even after he would examine him, he would say to the chola, what's your name and what's your mother's name? And he would be mispal for him. He said, that's not a double life, that's a broad life. That's a life that encompasses Torah and mitzvos and a secular career as well, that's not a conflict, but rather strengthens and reinforces that life. It's a beautiful, even poetic expression of the capacity we have to live in two worlds and make them one, of b'chol drachecha da'ehu, or b'chol ma'asecha yu l'shem shamayim. So he differentiated thusly. He said, the speech he gave in a school, learning from a professor, limud echol, is like getting nourishment from a cook. But learning from a Rebbe is like being nursed by one's own mother. So they're two different realms, two different disciplines. But your relationship to the one who teaches each has to be different. He and his wife were blessed with one child, a daughter named Bruria, who herself had an extensive secular education, including a doctorate from Columbia. She did her dissertation on the 19th century, also complicated Gadol, Reb Tzvi Hirsch Chayes, entitled The Dual Role of Reb Tzvi Hirsch Chayes, Traditionalist and Maskil. Rabbi Rakefet hypothesizes that she really had in mind her father when she wrote this dissertation, that is a person of great openness and worldliness inside the persona of a Hasidic Rebbe and Rosh Yeshiva. It's too psychoanalytical for me. I take no position on it. Obviously, the differences are very great. She, Bruria, married Rav Yonason David, who became Rosh Yeshiva in Chaim Berlin, and then in the yeshiva that Rav Huttner founded in Israel, Yeshiva's Pachad Yitzhak. She, for many decades in Israel, was the dean of the Beis Yaakov in Yerushalayim. They're both still alive. Nebuch, both were not blessed with children, so Rav Huttner will have no living offspring. I wonder, though, if it's wrong to ask, whether she encourages her students in Beis Yaakov to get the secular education that she received. And if not, why not? So that, too, is a complicated issue that many Gedolei Torah of the era wrestled with. They don't always allow what they themselves did. For example, I just saw the other day, Rav Chaim Kanievsky, the son of the Stipler, fought in the IDF in 1948. They had no choice. somehow he still became a gadol, notwithstanding that he fought in the army too. It's not a criticism as much as it is a mystery, which is not sufficient to say that times have changed. The breath of his wisdom and personality and his Torah greatness emerged from his mamorim, a unique blend of halacha, agada, and philosophy that he taught for decades but did not publish until the mid-1960s under the name Pachad Yitzchak. And they're divided to topic, Shabbos, all the Yom Tovim, extremely complex. I've never seen a verbatim translation of one. Rav Huttner is the type of Gadol B'Torah. He's often quoted just in terms of an idea that lends itself to a drasha, but the entire mimer is very abstruse. In that, he's like Rav Kook, whose influence is apparent but is never mentioned. I've tried over the years every now and then to give over some of his mamarim in shul from the text and count myself fortunate if I convey half of its profundity. So just to dip our toes in very briefly, if you turn the page, 6 through 9 is taken from Pachad Yitzchak on Shabbos, Maimer Aleph. So I'll just share in 3 minutes the gist of the idea. So the question we can understand, the answer is a little more complicated. We say in Musaf, Ta'amel Chayim Zachu, those who taste Shabbos, they merit life. V'gam ha'avim devareh gedula b'charu, and those who love devareh, its words, they have chosen greatness. It says that te'ima is connected to life, and ava to devarim. But what's the devareh? We only say this every week. Ha'avim devareh gedula b'charu. What's the devareh? Next, in Beis, he asks this question, something we all know. You make Sheva Brachas on Shabbos, you don't need Panim Chadashos. Why? Because Shabbos is considered Panim Chadashos. He quotes the Medrash, Mizmor Shil Yom HaShabbos, Panim Chadashos Bo Lekan. Okay, that's very good. That we know. Why? What does it really mean? See, it's a long, they're all long. This is actually a pretty short one, relatively. So he says, first of all, the Devarim of Shabbos is that when Shabbos came, it was a complete transformation of what's Iker and Tufel in the world. That we would think the 6 days of creation, it's a material world. That's the whole thing. Comes Shabbos and says, no, that's not the Iker. The Iker is the Ruchnius of the world, not the Gashmius of the world. That's Devarim Gedula Bacharu. So he goes on to say in number 7 that when God said Nase Adam means that He gave man Koach Hadas, the power of knowledge. The power of knowledge therefore works hand in hand with Shabbos. Go to 8. It's that knowledge that leads to the Maor Panav Shel Adam, the brightness, the luminescence of the human face. That's a reflection of the Koach Hadas, of the recognition of what's Iker and not Tafel. So he comes to 9, and I, by the way, I'm not even synopsizing. I'm synopsizing a synopsis. He says in 9 that that's Panim Chadashos, that when Shabbos comes, a Jew has a new face, we become new people. Why are we new people? Because the Koach Hadas in us is revitalized. Everything is different. Well, once again, in the world of the Iker and not the world of the Tafel, there's Simchat Nisuni, Be'etzem Simchat Chidush Adam. What's the celebration of marriage? Chidush Adam, new people, husband and wife joined together, new people. That Chidush Adam parallels what happens every Shabbos. We become new people as well. Therefore, Mizmor Shil Yom HaShabbos, Panim Chadashos Bo Lekan. Feel free, if you want, I'll make a copy of the entire mimer, because I left out, even in the text, I left out 2/3 of it. He has many other ideas, many other rayos. What messages did he try to convey? So very famous, I said this a number of times, he was once asked, what's the most important teaching to transmit to a Jewish child in America? He answered that we're the Am HaNivchar, we're a chosen nation, which is both a calling and a responsibility. And he considered it critical to a Jew's embrace of Torah that it must oscillate between two fundamental experiences, what he called Kabbalat Tanug, Kabbalat Ol. This is from the Sefer Zikaron on Daf Yud Gimel. I have it number 5 here. That David was punished when he said, Zmiros Hayli Chukecha, that your statutes are like music to me, because a Jew has to have both. A sense of tainug, that mitzvos and Torah give us pleasure and joy, but also all. There has to be acceptance of a yoke. If there's no acceptance of the yoke, it means that we don't recognize that we're servants of God with a sense of obligation. And of course, part of his complexity was his attitude, is encompassed in his attitude towards Israel and Zionism, which he had a clear demarcation. He loved the land of Israel. Its beauty and spirit, it pained him to leave. How much so? Look at number four. When he left Israel for the last time before he came to America, he wrote, it says, Igeres Kuf Samach Beis, B'dvaraya Odas HaFradom Eretz Yisrael, Eif Sharli Shalolat Gishat Kama Koshi Enim Ergish Bazeh. I can't but emphasize how much hardship I'm feeling. Hey, Ad Kama, L'mi Shalhoya B'kan V'lo Rab Einov, Eif Sharlit Sayer Ad Kama Magia Midat Kashrut Elah. No one who's not here can know the depth of my attachment. He's grateful to it because the Ruchnius of the land gave him insights in Torah. Ketzad, last line, Ketzad mipardimi mena, Ketzad. How does the person separate from the land of Israel? He's crushed. He went back several times, but he tilted away from Rav Kook and towards Satmar, even adopting the Satmar approach in blaming the Zionists for part of the Holocaust. And this is a very famous controversial essay that he wrote to the Jewish Observer in October 1977, exactly 41 years ago this month, that you have part of it in number 10. And I'll just read part of it. He complains about how public opinion is shaped not with a Torah view of a world, not with Das Torah, but with what advances someone's agenda. Third paragraph. Sadly, in even our own circles, the mold for shaping public opinion lies in the hands of the State of Israel. An example, appropriate example of this dangerous process of selectively rewriting history may be found in the extraordinary purging from the public record of all evidence of the culpability of the forerunners of the state in the tragedy of European Jewry and the substitution in its place of factors inconsequential to the calamity which ultimately occurred. What's he complaining about? To cover its own contribution to the final catastrophic events, those of the state in a position to influence public opinion, circulated the notorious canard that Gadol Yisrael were responsible for the destruction of many communities because they did not urge immigration. This charge is, of course, a gross distortion of the truth and need not be granted more dignity than it deserves by issuing a formal refutation. However, at the same time as the state made certain to include this charge as historical fact in every account of the war years, it successfully sought to omit any mention of its own contribution to the impending tragedy. What was its contribution? So he goes on to say that they antagonized the Mufti because they wanted a state. And the Mufti went to Berlin and talked Hitler into killing the Jews. Well, I'm not sure he's correct on any of those counts. Of course there are rabbis who told Jews not to leave, Rav Aaron Cutler being among them. See, blame the Zionists for provoking the Mufti, who spent the war years in Berlin, was an ally, if not a friend, of Hitler, but also, if truth be told, was a relatively minor figure in the calamity of the Holocaust. Rav Hutner argued that if not for the Zionists clamoring for a state, the Mufti would not have been anti-Jewish. But that is not a strong or very convincing argument, and it certainly can't justify the anti-state or anti-Zionist rhetoric after the war. To love Israel and hate the state is like to love marriage but hate your wife or husband, or maybe even not marry at all. And the public opinion he refers to doesn't mean it was in the official textbooks, but simply heard on the street. That's not the best way to write history. But on the other hand, those survivors who were told not to leave and left anyway, whose parents stayed behind and were murdered, so their memories were fresh, and many, of course, were still bitter. Now, to be fair, it must be said that the rabbis who told people not to leave Europe, and certainly by no stretch did all of them say that, not even most, but they said nothing would happen, so they were wrong retrospectively, but they were not wrong prospectively. They saw the U.S. as a place that would destroy Jewish souls. And who's to say they were wrong at that time? The fact is, the estimate is, about 6 million Jews, American Jews, have assimilated and been lost to Yadus over the last 80 years. So for the most part, that point was correct. They saw the impending Holocaust as a typical persecution, such that we'd had for 2,000 years, as a wave of anger and cruelty that would pass soon enough. So who could have predicted mass, systematic, industrial extermination? So this only becomes a critical problem if the working assumption is that rabbis are infallible, which is my working assumption, or if their Das Torah is unerring. Otherwise, you can't fault humans for not predicting the unprecedented. On the other hand, you can't deny it in order to sustain a philosophy that the rabbis always know and can predict the future, and a Ruach HaKodesh underwriting every utterance. To his credit, Rav Huttner bemoaned Jewish education's reluctance to deal with the Holocaust, including the Haredi world, part of the reason he wrote the article. He rejected, by the way, as a Zionist attempt to isolate the Holocaust from other catastrophes in Jewish history by calling it the Shoah. He always called it Churban Europa, the Churban of Europe, which to this day the Haredi world still does. And he said that part of the problem in schools in his time, maybe it's true today as well, is that they focus on what he called teaching the sunny side of Judaism, our chosenness. But part of that chosenness is the tochacha, that bad things happen to us as well, and children should know of it. And they'll see this as living proof of the Torah's veracity. But even though the premise, and it's such an interesting point, even though the premise of the tochacha is the cause and effect between sin and suffering, Rav Huttner explicitly and steadfastly refused to ascribe blame for the Holocaust to any specific sin. In fact, denying that sin played a role. And in this, he strenuously challenged the thesis of others, including Rav Avigdor Miller, who was the Mashgiach Ruchani in Chaim Berlin for years, until he left in 1964 as blaming the Holocaust on specific sins. What are the specific sins? I will tell you, it's a rough passage to read, but I'm reading from Avigdor Miller's book, Rejoice, O Youth. I quote, "Because so many European Jews fell into the error of admiring and emulating the Germans, God allowed the Germans to do their utmost to show who they really are. Those Jews who had begun to ignore the soul and imitation of the Gentiles devoted their efforts solely to the needs of the body, were made to see how their efforts ended in the worst ruination of Jewish bodies in history. Because so many imitated the Gentiles and refused to rest on Shabbos, they were forced to work 7 days a week at killing labor. Because they sent their children to non-Jewish or secular schools, no longer gave their children to Torah study, the Nazis were allowed to destroy Jewish children entirely. Because for the first time in Jewish history, women ceased to cover their hair, the Germans shaved them bald in the death camps. Because the virtues of chaste dress and behavior were diminished in imitation of the Gentiles, they were marched naked to the gas chambers, and Jewish women were subject to every barbarous indecency before being killed. Because they had so revered the physicians, especially the German specialists, they were subjected to the malicious experiments and torments which the German physicians impose upon them. Because they forsook the laws of the Torah, they were subjected to the Nuremberg laws, which deprived them of all the rights which other men enjoyed." Again, words of Rav Avigdor Miller in his book, Rejoice, O Youth. Rav Huttner disagreed, and disagreed vehemently. If you look at number 11, which is the last source, he said, "It should be needless to say at this point," it's entitled Tocha versus Specific Guilt, "that since the Churban of European Jewry was a Tochacha phenomenon, an enactment of the admonishment and rebuke which Klal Yisrael carries upon his shoulders as an integral part of being the Am HaNivchar, we have no right to interpret these events as any kind of specific punishment for specific sins. The Toch is a built-in aspect of the character of Klal Yisrael until Mashiach comes and his visit upon Klal Yisrael, the Creator's will, and for reasons known and comprehensible only to him. One would have to be a Navi or Tana to claim knowledge of the specific reasons for what befell anyone, for what befell us rather. And you see, it's a direct attempt to refute Rav Avigdor Miller. He said, this is a Klal Yisrael sin, not a specific sin. The punishment is not only to God, it's the Ratzon Hashem that we can't fathom. By the way, on this particular point, Lubavitcher Rebbe agreed wholeheartedly. I can see why that would be unsatisfying. Not that there's an explanation that would satisfy, certainly not emotionally, but coupled with his criticism of the secular Zionists for their role in the Churban Europa, many readers adopted this as the Haredi approach, that the Zionists perhaps inadvertently brought the Holocaust on the Jewish people. So to be sure, the Zionist establishment is not beyond reproach for their conduct, including, but not limited to, restricting visas to religious Jews who did, or denying visas to religious Jews who did not fit their description of the new Israeli Jew they wanted, and other sins. But to lay the Holocaust at their feet is a gross distortion and an obvious attempt to shield from criticism those leaders who actually were in Europe, as opposed to those who were not in Europe. What is clear, though, is that the Holocaust caused Rav Huttner to turn away from Rav Kook and become a passionate critic of the state and to hate Zionism. Ironic, then, that he was a victim of Arab terror. In 1970, Rav Huttner visited Israel, planning to start a yeshiva there. On the way back to New York, September 6, 1970, accompanied by his wife, daughter, and son-in-law, and of course other passengers, their TWA flight, remember them, TWA? 741 left Israel, stopped in Frankfurt, and after takeoff was hijacked by Arab terrorists from the PFLP, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, George Chabash's group. Two other planes that day were hijacked, Pan Am, remember them, and Swiss Air. All three planes wound up in Zarqa, Jordan, in an abandoned airfield. Same day, there was an attempted hijacking of an El Al plane, and it was thwarted by the passengers and some of the crew on board. For Rav Huttner's flight, the Jewish and non-Jewish passengers were separated, and they were held for weeks. The hijackers demanded the release of prisoners from Israel and Jordan. Israel refused. The standoff ended when Jordan went to war against the terrorists, and this became known as Black September. Terrorists exploded on the tarmac, the three empty planes. Syria mobilized for war against Jordan. Israel mobilized to stop Syria and protect Jordan. King Hussein engineered a brutal but effective massacre of the terrorist forces. Arafat and others were forced to take up hostile residence in Lebanon when they remained for another 12 years until Israel forced them out of Lebanon into Tunisia. Rav Huttner was saved. The other passengers released after 20 days in captivity. Apparently the terrorists confiscated his Torah manuscripts and they were never recovered. Things that he had written that he would never write again. He refused to eat non-kosher food, lost more than 40 pounds during those 20 days, but he saw this as an omen that the time had come to return to Israel. Note, it happened not on the flight to Israel, but on the flight from Israel. And that he did. 1975, founded Yeshiva Pachad Yitzchak, where his son-in-law became Rosh Yeshiva after Rav Huttner's death, maintaining a formal connection to Misifta Chaim Berlin. He visits twice a year. Nothing is without controversy. Rav Huttner designated his son-in-law and Rav Aaron Schechter, his student and longtime Rebbe in the yeshiva, as co-Rosh Yeshiva. This offended Rav Shlomo Karlebach, a cousin of the singer, who had been the Mashiach Ruchani for decades, and assumed that he would be asked to be Rosh Yeshiva. He wasn't. He summoned Rav Huttner to a Din Torah, and Rav Huttner refused to respond. He doesn't owe anyone an explanation. And Rav Karlebach then left. Rav Huttner died in Kislev of 1980, buried in Har HaZeitim. He spent his life, to quote Teddy Roosevelt, in the arena, never shying away from conflict or from advocating his views, never compromising on his vision, but also never being universally accepted, even the Haredi world, as was, say, Rav Aaron Cutler. He was strong, he was opinionated, arguably the greatest Haredi philosopher of his era. Not that the average person readily understands him. He lived in many different worlds, but he lives on, as do many great Talmidei Chachamim, through his writings and his Talmidim and theirs as well. But part of him will always remain just a little above us, a little out of reach. Yehi Zichro Baruch. If you think Rav Huttner was controversial, so next month we'll discuss the life and times and Torah of Rav Meir Kahana, Hashem Yukam Damo. Thank you all for coming.